This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Rising Force, Book 5 of the Ascension Series, written by Ken Lozito, performed by Jeff Hayes. Chapter 1. Zack sat in the cockpit of a Boxan strike fighter configured for atmospheric flight mode. The wing cannons could shoot ion bolts as well as kinetic weaponry, but they were presently disabled. A fully armed strike fighter also carried missiles whose payloads could be changed to suit their purpose in battle. The ship Zack was flying was for training purposes only. He'd spent a lot of time in training simulators and had recently been qualified to fly an actual strike fighter.
"Let's take it up a notch. I want you to take us beyond the atmosphere," Itanu said.
Itanu was a Nurshal, a humanoid species with dragonfly wings. They were skilled pilots and highly capable at calculating navigational coordinates. At one time, Itanu would have sooner seen Zack dead than flying in the same vehicle, but things had changed. The Nurshals lived their lives by a strict code of honor, and owing to the fact that Zack wasn't dead and that he and Itanu had survived being held prisoner by the Zaijins, they developed a strong friendship. Zack brought up the flight configuration on the internal heads-up display.
"Sounds good."
He increased the velocity and angled the trajectory 90 degrees. Zack couldn't feel any change in pressure thanks to the inertia dampeners. Without them, he would have been unconscious from the gravitational forces of such a turn. Zack found it hard to believe that he hadn't seen Earth in over a year. The closest he'd gotten was 8 months ago when he'd uploaded Drawer command protocols to the Star Shroud, causing it to converge around the Earth's star system and form a protective barrier that not even the Boxans could penetrate. What he hadn't anticipated was that they wouldn't be able to disable the barrier in order to get home themselves. As a result, he and the rest of the Athena crew were temporary residents of the Boxan colony world. Basic flying of the strike fighter had been easy to learn. Its computer systems used adaptive protocols to tweak the controls to the nuances of the pilot. Unlike Kalen and some of the others, Zack wasn't a pilot back on Earth, but the flight controls for the strike fighter were much easier for him to comprehend than the Athena's shuttle. Although perhaps not anymore, because it had been a few months since he'd been on the shuttle. The Athena was orbiting the planet, but he'd been in constant contact with the ship's artificial intelligence, which had become their unofficial 10th crew member. Zack used his neural implants to access the strike fighter's flight systems and gave the command to change the engine configuration for space flight mode. The main heads-up display showed the updated configuration and they passed through the edge of the atmosphere. He waited a few moments while their distance from the atmospheric edge increased, then used the maneuvering thrusters to swing the nose around to give them a view of the planet. Zack grinned. He'd been practicing that maneuver in the simulator and had botched his first few attempts when Kalen had been flying with him.
"Excellent," Itanu said. "Perhaps I'll tell Kalen that she distracts you too much on these flights." "It's the only way we get to be alone these days, between combat training and whatever the Mardoxian sect does when they snatch her away for their own training regimen," Zack said. "And here I thought you just wanted to get away from the physical rigors of combat training," Itanu said.
Zack snorted. "This is more fun than that stuff. I'm not a soldier and I don't ever plan on being a soldier. Honestly, I just want to get back to Earth and be with Kalen." Zack took in the view of the Boxan colony world. Oleron was decent enough, but it was a bit dry for his taste. Water covered only 60% of the planet's surface, and there was nowhere near the lushness when compared with Celebes Moon, a secondary habitable world in the Nerva star system and home to the Nurshals. Oleron was the only home the Boxans had left, and they defended that home fiercely. Zack couldn't imagine losing Earth, and given the state of human technology, humans wouldn't survive losing Earth either. Zack swung the nose of the ship 45 degrees to the right and sped toward the Athena.
"Where are you taking us?" Itanu asked.
"Home." "Well, my home, that is," Zack said. He needed to see the Athena. So much had happened to them aboard that ship that he sometimes felt lost without it.
"You'll get back to Earth someday," Itanu said.
"I know, but combat training isn't going to get me there any quicker. I need to spend more time trying to decipher what the Drawer did to our ship. There are still vast parts of the Athena's computing systems that I can't access, nor can the AI," Zack said. Itanu blew out a harsh breath at the mention of the AI.
"Come on," Zack said.
You need to learn to work with AIs. When done properly, they can be a tremendous help.
Our experience has been less fortuitous when dealing with an AI than yours has been, Itanu said.
That's because the AI you were working with was based on Zaijin design, and I think we can agree that anything they touch only benefits them, Zack said.
So you think the Zaijins wanted our artificial intelligence experiments to fail?
Maybe. Another way to keep you dependent on them, I suppose. Look, I don't expect you to change your mind, but I would encourage you to consider developing your own when you eventually return to Nerva, Zack said. Itanu was silent, but Zack could tell the Nershal was considering what he'd said. Finally, Itanu answered,
I'd do it with your help.
Really? That's great! We could probably adapt a version of the Athena's AI for you to use. I mean, it was based on the Boxen AI that was used to manage the monitoring station in our star system, Zack said.
Yeah, but you modified it, and it's something different from what the Boxens created. Even Garak agrees with that, Itanu said.
You are correct, the AI said, its voice coming from their helmet speakers. My origin is somewhat unique, but I would be happy to create a base AI that stems from my programming to suit your needs.
Zack glanced at Itanu in surprise.
Wait a minute, Athena. Did you just say you can create more of you, as in, like a child?
The context would fit in this instance. Does this surprise you?
The AI asked.
Damn right it does, Zack said.
I'm not sure I understand, the AI replied. Besides you, no other crew member knows my programming as well as I do. Why shouldn't I be able to create alternative versions of myself for the Nershals to use?
I think it might be a bit more complicated than you think it would be, Zack said.
I shall devote some processing time to the problem and provide you with a report, the AI said.
Zack looked up at the HUD and saw that Itanu was watching him from the rear seat.
What? Zack asked. You mentioned before how you'd like to return to Earth and be with Kalin. I'm trying to understand what this means. You're with her here, but I don't think that's what you mean, Itanu said.
Oh, I was thinking just the two of us taking it easy on a beach somewhere, Zack said.
And you find such an existence fulfilling?
Well, yeah, Zack said, and his mouth hung open while he tried to formulate his thoughts. Just her and me on a beautiful beach. Bathing suits, drinks, the warm Caribbean waters, and no one trying to kill us. Yeah, I would like that very much.
I don't think I understand you humans at all. Here, in this moment, you are a designated mating pair, but you feel you can't be alone because the Zaijins are hunting you. The Zaijin aren't here. What's stopping you from doing as you wish right now? Itanu asked.
Zack frowned. Majasilax and the other Mardoxian sect members have her so busy that we barely have any time for each other at all.
Have you communicated your desires to Kalin? Itanu asked.
Zack rolled his eyes.
What are you, the relationship police or something? You didn't answer my question.
Zack shook his head and sighed. No, I haven't talked to her about it. He just wanted to get aboard the Athena and forget about Alaron, the Boxens, and the fact that they'd been kept so busy that they could hardly focus on any one thing for very long.
You pride yourself on being able to solve problems, and yet this one causes you to stumble.
Itanu said, and a series of high-pitched grunts sounded from the rear of the cockpit.
Are you laughing at me?
The sounds from the Nershal came in longer bursts, and Zack ground his teeth in frustration.
Fine. Laugh it up. Next time I see Kalin, I'll just steal her away for a while, Zack said.
The Nershal's laughter ceased.
Now you're making sense.
As they got closer to the Athena, the white outer hull gleamed with a bit of silver, and Zack drew in a deep breath, feeling his shoulders relax. He felt more at ease on the Athena than he did on the planet below them. Zack harumphed, seeing the Athena was both a relief and a reminder of how far they had yet to go. The ship was tiny by Boxen standards, but thanks to the drawer it now contained more advanced technology than even the Boxens had. The Boxens had been able to help decipher some of what the million-year-old drawer AI had done to their ship, but though it had been 8 months since that had happened, they were still in the dark as to the extent of the changes. One thing that had soon become apparent to all the crew members was the usefulness of the upgrades to their neural implants. The implants had been linked to their PDAs, and they still were to a certain extent, but they had the ability to function equally as well without them. As a result, the Athena crew members were able to multitask much better than they had before. Executing a task had required a fair amount of concentration before the upgrade, but now they could be performed almost as fast as it took to formulate the thought. The security protocols had also been updated so only the Athena crew could access the computer systems of the ship. They'd been able to give the Boxons provisional access, but no matter what Zack did, the Boxons were severely limited in what they could do without one of the original Athena crew members present. Zack was aware of how the Boxons had tried to bypass the security protocols and access the ship's systems directly, so those security protocols had kept the Boxons honest.
So this is what Hicks refers to as hearing you think. You know, when you're so focused you start to forget things like slowing the ship down so we don't crash, Etanu said.
Zack's thoughts snapped back to the strike fighter's controls and he slowed their approach.
I was thinking of some things, Zack said.
Like what?
When we first got here, I thought we'd focus more on what the Drar did to the Athena, and for the first month or so, things were like that.
But not now, Zack said.
The Boxons are sharing their knowledge and training all of you on their systems. It is a great gift, Etanu said.
I realize that, but part of me keeps thinking that we're being kept busy on purpose.
Why?
I don't know. To keep us here longer?
We should have gone back to our star system by now to try and open the barrier, Zack said. It's not safe. Not with the Zaijin fleet in the area, Etanu said.
They can't be everywhere at once.
The barrier is a blessing. It's the only thing that saved your home world from being invaded by the Zaijins. What if you were to bring down the barrier and then not be able to re-engage it?
Etanu asked. Earth would be vulnerable to attack, I know. But still, I wanted to test some shroud devices and there aren't any here, Zack said.
They destroyed what they could when they lost Sethion, and the rest are in comms blackout until the Zaijin threat passes, Etanu said.
A 60-year blackout? That seems extreme to me.
What did Garrok say about this?
He told me he would look into finding some shroud devices we could experiment with. But to be fair, I only asked him about it last week. I got the impression that he thought it was a good idea, Zack said.
Well then, you just need to be patient, Etanu said.
This time Zack laughed. Perhaps I should send Udon Zari a message that you finally learned about being patient.
I wouldn't, Etanu said.
Zack stopped laughing.
Why not?
Because he'll request that I come back to Nerva and join the fleet, Etanu said.
I thought that would be a good thing. Since the Zaijins have been ousted from Nerva, it should be safe to return now, Zack said.
We didn't oust them. We appealed to the Confederation, and the member species voted for the Zaijins to leave on our behalf, Etanu said.
I thought the Zaijins controlled the Federation.
They do, which is why the Nershal military has been on high alert. Our last clash with the Zaijins revealed to them that we had allied ourselves with the Boxons, Etanu said.
Plus, the Zaijins needed their fleet to invade Earth, so you guys got a break.
It's a good thing, Zack said.
No, it's not.
Zack matched the strike fighter's speed with the Athena's orbital velocity, so it appeared they had stopped.
What do you mean it's not? Zack asked.
Peace in our star system at the expense of yours is not a good thing. No species should have to live with the threat of a Zaijin invasion, Etanu said.
Zack nodded. He hated the Zaijins as much as Etanu did, and the fact that he'd brought up the barrier had killed thousands of Zaijins hadn't bothered him. Condra Renee's face still haunted his dream sometimes. The female Zaijin had tortured him to get information about Earth and how he and his fellow humans had arrived in the Nerva star system. At least Zack had been able to resist the Zaijin compulsion capability. Brenda and Emma strongly believed it was because he loved Kaelin, and that shielded him from the Zaijin's pheromones. Jonah Redford hadn't been as lucky, but Zack was pretty sure Jonah loved himself and science above all else. And that hadn't shielded him. Jonah had fought it as best he could, but it wasn't until they were on the ancient Drar space station that he experienced any relief from his symptoms. Zack glanced at the top observatory on the Athena. Jonah's lab was there, and though the astrophysicist was no longer with them, there were still reminders of him in his lab. Zack had searched for some clue as to how the Drar had been able to alleviate Jonah's symptoms. It's been a far cry from a cure, but it might bring those who were afflicted with Zaijin compulsion some peace. So far, he'd been unsuccessful.
It wasn't as if the drawer had any specific data about the Zaijin specifically, but their AI had been able to diagnose and treat the symptoms until Jonah died. The drawer had given them a tremendous gift that would take them years to even go through and catalog properly, and it would take much more than the crew of the Athena. The more Zack thought about it, the more he kept coming back to their need to get the Athena back home to Earth.
"Do you think the Boxons are lying about having no access to a Star Shroud device?" Itanu asked.
"Not Garrok." "I trust him, but the others I'm not so sure of. I mean, I don't think they'd lie to harm us, but some Boxons have a superiority complex that the others would say made a conflict with a species like the Zaijins inevitable," Zack said.
"They're learning how to deal with that, I think," Itanu said.
"Yeah, but that perception is still there," Zack said. He sent a command over to the Athena to open the airlock doors and had the strike fighter's autopilot maintain the ship's position relative to the Athena.
"Are you ready?" Zack asked. "I'm always ready." "You're the one who forgets crucial pieces of equipment," Itanu said.
"Are you ever going to let me forget about that?" Zack said, remembering the terrifying experience of being exposed to outer space without a helmet. He was about to open the canopy when a comms channel opened from the planet.
"Congratulations on making it all the way to the Athena. But now I'm afraid you'll need to come back to Alaron," Hicks's voice said over comms.
"Why? What's going on?" Zack asked.
"Lattimore has returned, and he'll be reporting on what they found back home," Hicks said.
Zack's eyes widened.
"All right, we're on our way."
Lattimore had left them a few weeks earlier to do some reconnaissance near the barrier protecting Earth's star system. It had been a calm, silent mission. No communications allowed back to the colony, so they hadn't gotten a status update. Zack regained control of the strike fighter and sped back toward the planet.
"Remember to angle your approach unless you prefer to kill us during re-entry," Itanu said.
"I know," Zack said, noticing that he was coming in a bit too steep and adjusting accordingly. Chapter 2 Kalen was in a simulated environment meant for training Mardoxian sect members, whom their translator referred to as priests and priestesses. She was floating in a virtual world, surrounded by different types of metallic blocks. The blocks converged in front of her, forming an artificial landscape. She touched down to the smooth surface and felt gravity return to the simulation. Kalen ran forward, maintaining her awareness of the surrounding area. She had done enough of these exercises to know that the Boxons loved to change the playing field, forcing her to adapt or fail to reach her objective. As she ran, she extended her senses out from her. The artificial landscape changed, becoming uneven, and several tall shafts extended from the floor. Kalen leaped, grabbing onto one of the nearest ones, and it propelled her to the top. She gazed down at the floor and watched as it disintegrated, revealing a dark nothingness beyond. Kalen pulled herself up and stood with her head held high. The Mardoxian sect's training methodology forced their initiates to trust their instincts, allowing their reliance on the sixth sense to become instinctual. Officially, Kalen wasn't an initiate into the sect because she was human, but was allowed to train with them. Majasilax had told Kalen that their training would allow her to further develop her gifts, and the Boxan priestess had been right. Kalen's concentration hardly ever wavered, and she'd participated in practice sessions where she'd had to navigate through the obstacles in front of her as well as monitoring a half a dozen other environments. At first she'd failed miserably, but after these many months on Alaron, she was mastering what she would have thought were impossible feats before. Kalen sat down and closed her eyes to begin meditating, breathing in smooth, even breaths and quieting her mind. Majasilax had told her the brain was a machine that was always working and was her single most powerful asset. When she meditated, she sometimes imagined she was standing in the midst of a thick fog. She wasn't afraid, and she didn't try to control the fog, but accepted her place in it. In this case, the swirling fog thickened, and Kalen cocked her head to the side, listening to a faint sound in the distance. She focused on the source of the sound and felt as if she were drifting forward through the fog toward the origin of the noise. A harsh clang echoed around her, along with heavy footfalls crunching on gravelly ground. A Boxan blaster fired, and she cringed. There was a deep rumbling of Boxans speaking in muted tones as if she were listening to them from the other side of a thick wall. Kalen relaxed and didn't try to force what she was experiencing.
but Jassilax had taught her that sometimes it was best to allow the things she saw to unfold. The skin on her forehead chilled painfully as a sharp breeze blew against her face. Plasma bolts blazed through the air, and she felt as if she were standing on a frigid battlefield. Boxins in full power armor stomped loudly nearby. Kaelin peered through the fog, but only caught brief glimpses of what she knew must have been there. There was a loud clearing of the throat, and Kaelin spun around. A Boxin stood there in strange red power armor that was unlike anything she'd seen before. The Boxin crouched down and placed its hand on the ground as if trying to sense something Kaelin couldn't see. Then the Boxin turned around, and the helmeted head looked directly at her. Kaelin gasped. The towering form of the Boxin lurched backward as if surprised by Kaelin's presence. She heard a tone that was soft at first, but steadily gained in intensity. Then the fog disappeared as if there were a giant vacuum that had sucked it all away, and the battle sounds faded. The latch to the door moved, and the simulator door opened. Noises from the chamber beyond barreled their way in, and Kaelin squinted. Light poured through the rounded edges of the doorway. The simulation chamber was soundproof, and it took Kaelin a few moments to get her bearings. Majasilax peered inside.
"I didn't want to pull you out when you were so deep in meditation, but Claddamore has returned. Our presence is requested in the High Council chambers to hear his report."
Kaelin grabbed the handle and climbed to her feet. The simulator was designed for Boxins, who averaged 8 to 10 feet in height. Her own 5'10" were a pittance in comparison. Her mouth was dry, and she took a sip of water from the canister she'd set outside before going into the simulator. She rolled her shoulders, stretching stiff muscles, and glanced at her PDA, then looked at Majasilax in surprise.
6 hours? Kaelin asked.
"We decided to let you go on longer than before to see how it affected your performance," Majasilax said.
Kaelin frowned. It certainly hadn't felt like she'd been in there that long, but it did explain why she was a bit stiff from sitting for so long.
"I saw it again. Boxins on a battlefield somewhere. They were fighting," Kaelin said.
Majasilax led her away from the simulation chamber.
"Do you remember any details?"
she asked.
"Someone was wearing red power armor, but it looked different than what I've seen here in the colony. I think the Boxins saw me or sensed me somehow. They reacted to my presence,"
Kaelin said. Majasilax gave her a sidelong glance. The Mardoxian priestess came to a stop and approached a wall terminal where a holoscreen flickered on. Kaelin watched as a cycle of Boxan power armor images flicked past the screen. Kaelin pointed to one.
"That's pretty close to what I saw."
She leaned in to get a better look and then nodded up to Majasilax.
"It's traditional combat armor from before the war with the Zygins. More decorative than practical,"
Majasilax said. She closed down the terminal and waved for Kaelin to follow.
"I don't know why I keep seeing a battle. I don't even know where it is,"
Kaelin said.
"It may not be taking place anywhere. You're quite gifted, and it could be that you're seeing another Boxin's experiences. Most of the Boxins here have seen combat, and every Boxin is required to learn basic combat skills," Majasilax said.
Kaelin's brows squished together.
"I don't understand. How could I see another Boxin's experiences?"
"You're participating with the other Athena crew members in combat training as well as what we're doing here, plus working on understanding what the Drar AI has done to your ship. Your vital signs were showing a sleep pattern," Majasilax said.
"Sleep? You mean I'm dreaming instead of seeing an actual event taking place?"
Kaelin asked.
"Yes,"
Majasilax said. Kaelin chewed on the inside of her cheek and thought. They were all working hard, but it had seemed so real. She'd heard the battle as if she were standing there on the battlefield. She'd felt the moisture on her skin and knew the Boxin in the red armor had seen her. She glanced at Majasilax, but didn't say anything. It was a strange thing to suggest, and Kaelin wondered if Majasilax was testing her in some way. They were all working hard. Other than the two of them sleeping in the same bed, she had hardly any time to spend with Zack. They went through the doors into the warm, arid outdoor air and blazing sunlight. This was a marked difference from the high humidity the Boxins preferred, like their home planet of Sethion. Alaron was a world with hotter temperatures due to its orbit being closer to the star in this system. The planet had large land masses and oceans that covered about 60% of the planet's surface, but when compared with the Earth that had over 70% of its surface covered in water, it made for a much drier atmosphere. Kalen followed Majasalax over to the transit pad they'd use to quickly travel to the High Council Chambers. The Boxens had been residents of this planet for 50 years. It had begun as a small outpost, secreted away, and it was that secret that had saved them from the Zygins. Kalen had asked Majasalax whether they would have considered going to a star system like Earth if they hadn't had Alaron. The Mardoxian priestess had given her a vague answer, but it still left Kalen wondering what the Boxen's future plans were. They couldn't fight a war with the Zygins forever. Kalen used her PDA to check the location of the rest of the Athena's crew, and all of them were heading for the General Assembly, but Kalen frowned when she saw Zack's location. He had gone back to the ship again. He'd been withdrawing from the others and making regular trips back to the Athena. She sometimes found that the others would do something similar, herself included. The Athena was their link to home, and sometimes being on their ship made them feel closer to home than being on the surface of the Boxan colony world did. The transit pad hovered above the ground and then slowly rose into the air over the Mardoxian building complex. The wind blew Kalen's dark hair back, giving her a momentary reprieve from the heat. They headed toward a large dome-shaped building that other transit pads were approaching. The pads had no railings, but they didn't need any. The sensors wouldn't let anyone fall off during their short flight. Kalen glanced up and saw a strike fighter flying over them, and her lips lifted a bit, knowing Zack was inside. He'd flown with Atanu today since she'd been training with Majasalax. She turned back toward the dome, eager to learn what Clattimore had found during his reconnaissance mission back to Earth's star system. The decision for them not to go with Clattimore had been difficult to make, but ultimately they needed to focus on their work here and learn all they could about what the Drawer had done to the Athena. And Kalen marveled at what they'd been able to figure out. The Drawer space station had remade the Athena by merging their technology with what had been built on Earth. There were some systems that not even the Boxens understood. Prior to entering the Drawer space station, the Athena's hull hadn't been in the best of shape, which Hicks kept bringing up as a risk to all on board. All of those issues were gone. The hull material was in pristine shape, made of a radically advanced ceramic composite. They'd found references to the new composite formulas, but it would take them time to reproduce it. While the artificial intelligence on the Drawer station had enhanced their ship, it hadn't included any weapon that would give them an edge in combat. At least not directly. There was no big gun they could use to take out hordes of Zygins, and to Kalen that was quite a telling statement on the part of the Drawer AI. The transit pad slowed its approach and landed just outside the domed building where the Boxan High Council met. As Kalen stepped off, alarms blared near them, along with the sound of strike fighter engines as Zack brought it down for an impromptu landing in a clearing a short distance away. Boxan soldiers raced over to the craft while Zack and Atanu exited the ship. Kalen watched as Zack gestured over to where Kalen and Majasalax waited, and the soldiers let them pass.
"Nice landing, although I don't think they appreciated it," Kalen said to Zack.
Zack grinned. "Atanu mentioned something about surprise landings and that there wouldn't always be a designated area for them."
"Don't you blame this on me. I was referring to what you'd do if your ship was damaged and you needed an emergency landing," Atanu said.
Zack rolled his eyes. "I set it down right over there, and everything turned out fine." Kalen had been around Zack long enough to learn some of his behavior patterns. He was getting restless, and these little moments of rebellion were indications that he needed a change.
"Zack," Kalen said, "landing a strike fighter in the middle of a populated area isn't the best way to treat our hosts."
Zack blew out a breath. "Fine. I'll move it after we're done here." They headed inside, and Kalen fell into step next to him. She leaned over so only he could hear.
"It was a good landing."
"Thanks," Zack said, with half a smile. "Maybe when this is over, we can take a ride?" Kalen nodded, but wondered whether the Boxens would allow Zack to keep flying after his little stunt. If anything, the Boxens were rigid in their rules of expected behavior from their guests. They met up with the rest of the Athena's crew, and Hicks worked his way over to Zack.
"Why didn't you join us this morning?" Hicks asked.
"I'm not doing combat training anymore," Zack said.
"How come?"
I know the basics, and that's enough for now. I'm going to spend more time working with the Athena's systems, Zack said.
Hicks nodded.
That's fine. We just didn't know where you were.
Zack glanced at Hicks for a moment. Etanu was giving me a flying lesson.
Excellent. But I did want to tell you that you might have liked what we were doing today, Hicks said.
Zack's brows pushed forward.
What were you guys doing?
We got to use their exoskeletal suits, Hicks said.
Zack's eyes widened. The ones that make you super strong and jump really high? Hicks nodded.
Kaylin grinned as she watched the warring emotions on Zack's face. It must have been every little boy's dream to put on a suit of armor that could make them super strong and impervious to danger. Since this briefing pertained to them directly, Kaylin and the others were ushered to a designated area set aside for them near the front. The Boxens were a large race of beings and made every effort to be sure their guests were comfortable, which included appropriately sized chairs for them to sit on. Majaslax went over to where the Mardoxian sect representatives gathered in the High Assembly. There was a deep, quiet murmuring throughout the vast hall, but there were only about 50 Boxens in attendance. The Boxan High Council was made up of 7 members that included their leader, who was a Boxen named Awan. Awan glanced over at Kaylin and the others.
Thank you for coming on such short notice. When we received Clattermore's communications, we anticipated that you'd be as eager to hear the news as we are.
Thank you, High Counselor, Kaylin replied.
The crew of the Athena had decided that she was to speak for them. A door on the far side of the chamber opened, and Clattermore entered, followed by Garrock and some other members of his crew. Kaylin had noted that Clattermore preferred to work with the same crew when he embarked on missions, but she'd later learned that the battle commander was a bit of an outsider even among his own species. He was the only living Boxen to be brought back from the brink of madness at the hands of the Zaijins and their compulsion ability. It was fair to say that Clattermore was once a war hero who was no longer entirely trusted by his own race. Majaslax had vouched for him, and it was through the High Council's respect for the Mardoxian sect that Clattermore was still able to serve. Clattermore walked over to the designated speakers area and glanced at the Athena's crew. His facial features could have been chiseled from stone for all they gave away. High Counselor Awan brought the assembly to a start.
Battle Commander, please report your findings to us. We returned to the Sol system to study the Shroud Barrier, and have learned that it possesses the same energy signature as the barrier we encountered at the Drawer space station. There were no offensive capabilities, but that was expected. The sequence of code used to realign the Shroud device and change its composition wouldn't give it offensive capabilities, Clattermore said. So the Earth is protected for the time being,
High Counselor Awan said.
That's true. But I have more to report, Clattermore said. Please, continue. We ran a multitude of tests on the barrier, and it's capable of withstanding an assault from our most powerful weapons. However, the barrier is shrinking, Clattermore said.
Kaylin stood up. How fast is it shrinking?
Clattermore turned toward her.
We're not sure. We've left sensor equipment to monitor and measure, but it will require another mission to retrieve the data.
Are the Zaijins still there? Kaylin asked.
There was no Zaijin presence detected, just a vast field of wreckage from the ships they weren't able to salvage, Clattermore said.
Were there any survivors from the dreadnoughts? Kaylin asked.
No. Unfortunately not. The dreadnoughts were completely destroyed. But we did find a data recorder jettisoned prior to the battle,
Clattermore said, and returned back to the High Council.
Prax Badax sent non-essential personnel, tech platforms, and orbital defense platforms back to Earth before engaging the Zaijins. There's an excellent chance that there are surviving Boxens and humans alive in the Sol system.
High Counselor Awan shifted his gaze to Kaylin.
What do you think your race will do?
Kaylin glanced at the others, unsure what to say. Anything she said would be pure speculation.
I'd like to think they would be working together.
Hicks stood up, and the High Counselor nodded for him to speak.
The data we collected prior to leaving showed that the Zaijins were sending asteroids to the interior of the star system. They were likely targeting Earth. A clear and present danger like that would have caused the cooperation of Earth's militaries. They would have joined together to mitigate the attack. Assuming they all survived, and with the help of the Boxons, my guess would be that they're building a fleet to protect themselves.
Kaelin looked at the Boxons on the High Council and got the impression that none of them were pleased. Clattamore cleared his throat.
The data recorder also contained Praxpadax's personal logs. He was aware that he'd broken protocol for dealing with a less advanced species. He recognized, as I have, that in order to survive, we must work with species like the humans.
Praxpadax operated outside of his mandate to protect the Earth. Those protocols are in place to ensure a safe path for all those involved. We intend to work with the humans, but Praxpadax's actions may have put them in even more danger,
High Counselor Awan said. Zack let out a bitter laugh while coming to his feet.
What are you doing? Kaelin asked.
No, I finally get it. I see what's going on here, Zack said to Kaelin. They are angry that Praxpadax deviated from protocol and took an action that was outside the confines of the Council. Zack turned toward the Council. He was there, and he decided that the best course of action was to share your precious technology with us so we could all have a fighting chance against the Zygins. Does that about sum it up?
Zack,
Hicks warned.
No, Zack said. I want them to answer. We're here right now today because they tried to control the galaxy with an iron fist. Tell me, what were Praxpadax's orders if the Zygins defeated your ships?
Kaelin's face flushed until she realized the implications of what Zack was saying. She stood by his side and faced the High Council.
It's a fair question, and one that needs to be answered, she said in a steely tone.
High Counselor Awan shifted his feet and faced them fully.
Yours is a species that we cannot allow to fall to the Zygins. Your species is the only other race we've encountered with the Mardoxian potential. Battle leader Praxpadax was tasked with protecting your planet at all costs. But if he was unable to complete this task, then he was to prevent the Earth from becoming an asset to the Zygins.
Zack growled in disgust.
Unbelievable.
Kaelin's mouth hung open in disbelief. She looked at Majasalax, who was watching her intently. Kaelin was prepared to work with the Boxons and make this alliance work, but this was too much.
I realize that our stance appears to be harsh, and I understand your initial response,
High Counselor Awan said.
I don't think you do. Not really, Kaelin said. How can you expect us to be in alliance with you with these kinds of contingency plans?
We expect you to respect our judgment,
High Counselor Awan said.
This is bullshit, Zack said.
Hold on a minute, Hicks said. If our survival was at stake, do you think our own governments would react differently?
Yes, we would, because we're not all military. Not everything is a damn objective. We don't quantify life as a numbers game, Kaelin snapped.
You are exactly right, Majasalax said, drawing their attention. And not only that, Praxpadax agreed as well, she said, and then faced the High Council. Praxpadax's record shows a strong alignment with our original ideas. He represented the best among us, and yet, upon meeting with the humans directly, he changed his mind. He saw something in them, much as Clattamore and I have, that has influenced us to question some of our stricter protocols.
These are the protocols that have allowed us to survive,
High Counselor Awan said.
No doubt Praxpadax thought the same thing. But do you see their reactions?
Majasalax said, and the Boxons in the chamber swung their gazes toward the crew of the Athena.
They are but a few, but I would place a strong probability that their reactions are aligned with the rest of their species. If we persist along this path, no species will enter an alliance with us.
There were a few moments of heavy silence. High Counselor Awan glanced at the other members of the High Council and then turned back toward Kaelin and the others.
We respect the Council of the Mardoxian sect, and each of us will spend time in quiet meditation, considering the implications of our actions.
The Boxon High Counselor waited.
Thank you,
Kaelin said in a neutral tone. She glanced at Zack, who was seething, and the rest of the crew had guarded expressions.
When will another team return to the Sol system? We need to understand how long the barrier can last before the system itself is in jeopardy, Kaelin said.
We will send a regular team to investigate shortly, and then compile and analyze the data here. Is that acceptable?
High Counselor Awan asked. Kaelin nodded.
Good. I have a request here from our scientific division. They're asking that the Athena be docked and its components studied directly,
Awan said. Unacceptable, Kaelin said. In fact, some members of my crew have expressed interest in spending more time on the Athena to study the Drar improvements. Those efforts were previously put on hold to allow you to perform your remote analysis while you educated us on some of your technology. Now that we have that foundation, we're in a position to better understand what was done to our ship.
The High Counselor paused before answering. Clearly, he hadn't expected Kaelin's response.
Of course. We understand and shall assist however we can.
Kaelin nodded and found that she wanted to put some distance between herself and the Boxons. She caught Clattimore watching her, and she had the impression that there was more he wanted to say to them. She turned toward the rest of the crew.
I think we need to talk about a few things.
The rest of them agreed. Kaelin looked back at the Boxons, thinking that for all their advanced technology and their dry, logical approach to anything in their path, they seemed to be forgetting a very important thing. All life wanted to live and would struggle to do so regardless of everything else. The Boxons had spent too much time surviving and not enough time living, and their race was suffering because of it. Chapter 3 8 months had passed since the Earth was almost destroyed. 8 months since the skies above Earth were forever changed. Ed Johnson still caught himself looking up at the new moon as if he still couldn't quite believe it was there. At the same time, he thought it was a daily reminder of the danger Earth was in. Ed drained the last of his bourbon and set the cup down. The brisk air of the Blue Ridge Mountains had more than a chill to it, but he'd always found that the rooftop patio of his secret hideaway held some semblance of peace. A place to recharge his batteries with its scenic views of the surrounding forests and a clear view of the stars. He gazed at the new moon, which was visibly smaller than the old one, but no less beautiful. Some astronomers wanted to call the new moon Hephaestus, blacksmith of the gods who made weapons of divine strength, and Ed supposed their efforts on the mineral-rich new moon fit the name. Mining efforts had been underway for several months while tech bases were constructed so they could finally build spaceships of their own. He should be pleased with what they'd accomplished in such a short span of time. But he wasn't. The Earth had been given a reprieve from an alien fleet that wanted to invade, but the fact that they were completely cut off from the rest of the galaxy even confused the Boxons. Boxan scientists had surmised that the barrier surrounding their solar system had to do with the Star Shroud, but even they were at a loss as to what had happened. The star shrouds were designed to filter out artificial wavelengths from penetrating a star system's interior while allowing outbound observations to occur without interference. They were a miracle of engineering that most scientists had trouble coming to grips with. Physicists from the mid-20th century had theorized the existence of a Dyson sphere, which was a hypothetical megastructure built around a star to capture the energy coming from it, but even Ed understood that the Star Shroud was way beyond those theoretical concepts. Zack Quick had been the first to crack the signal the Shroud devices used to communicate with one another. The young hacker had sent all his findings back to Earth before the Athena disappeared, but nothing he'd sent back had allowed them to communicate with the Shroud devices since the barrier. Not even the Boxons were able to control them. They were still deploying tiny monitoring drones that would report back to Earth about the barrier. The barrier was the source of many debates around the globe. Since the barrier was in place, wasn't the Earth safe now? The barrier had blocked the Zygin ships from reaching Earth, so why did they need to devote all their resources to building ships of their own? Thankfully, there were opposing arguments that were much more sensible.
Ed, the meeting is about to begin,
Iris called to him. Ed turned around and crossed the rooftop patio to where Iris Barrett, his personal assistant and bodyguard, had set up mobile communications. Iris clicked her wrists together to activate the controls and several holoscreens came on. After a few moments, a view of General Sheridan sitting at the head of a long conference table came into view. The general wore his army fatigues, and his short, gunmetal gray hair showed white around his ears. Officially, the Earth Coalition Force, or ECF, was under the dominion of the United Nations Security Council, which Ed found interesting because China and Russia still hadn't ratified it. In reality, the ECF existed in a gray area of international politics. Most of the ECF funding was coming from the other permanent member states of the UN, like the United States, France, and the United Kingdom, along with non-permanent member states like Japan, among many others. It wasn't enough, and this UN Security Council meeting was a long time coming. Here, they could finally nail down more support for the ECF.
"Hello, William," Ed said.
Another holoscreen came up and showed the UN Security Council chambers. A large circular desk was in the center of the room where nations could come and work together to maintain peace and security.
"Let's hope Rebecca Sharp is on top of her game today," Sheridan said.
"She's good, and always on top of her game. She wouldn't be an ambassador if she weren't," Ed said.
Sheridan arched a brow and leaned toward the screen. Their comms channel was encrypted, so there was no chance that someone else could be listening in on them.
"Did her appointment to the UN involve you in any way?"
Ed chuckled.
"You give me too much credit. It's in our best interest to know who all the power players are."
"So what's this going to cost us?"
Sheridan asked.
"A lot. The Chinese are tough negotiators," Ed said.
"And the Russians?"
"They'll likely follow China's lead. But we need their help," Ed said.
Sheridan snorted.
"Believe what you want, but China has one of the largest workforces in the world, which is something we need to build a fleet."
"You know, I've spent a majority of my career neutralizing threats from them, and getting into bed like this will change things. We're not going to become allies overnight," Sheridan said.
"We have to change. Otherwise, there won't be many of us left."
General Sheridan eyed him for a moment.
"I know what they're going to ask for, and I'm sure you have a good idea as well."
"Of course. They'll want access to Boxan technology, as well as a few slots on your senior staff."
"And you'd be okay with that?"
Ed knew it didn't matter what he'd be willing to accept. Sheridan just wanted to know his perspective. It was the mark of an excellent leader to consider other viewpoints when making decisions.
"What I'd be okay with has little bearing on any of this. Can you function with those terms? Do you think the ECF would thrive with those terms?" Ed asked.
"What good will it do if we build our own ships to start shooting each other with? That's not going to stop the Zaijins."
"First, we have to build a fleet. Then we have to be able to hold our own against the Zaijins. Whatever comes after that will be someone else's problem. I do think that both the Russians and the Chinese can bring a valuable perspective to the table," Ed said.
"What's that?"
"Both of them have had to contend with how to counter a superior military force for a long time. They've spent years developing ways to outthink a more powerful enemy. It's this perspective that will be valuable to the ECF," Ed said.
"While gaining a technological advantage that is leaps and bounds over what they had before," Sheridan said.
"So will we. One thing history has taught us is that having an advantage and strategically executing an advantage are two different things. It's what we're able to do with the technology and our ability to keep it in working order that will prove which of us is going to last."
They watched the UN Security Council session. Rebecca Sharp deftly steered the meeting to the primary agenda, and events unfolded much as Ed expected they would until it came time for China's UN ambassador to present the People's Liberation Army's top pick to join the ECF, General Heng Sheng. Sheridan leaned back in his chair, shaking his head.
"They can't be serious. Sheng was indicted for fraud and corruption."
Ed brought up Sheng's dossier on his holoscreen. Sheng was one brutal SOB with a record for placing a high priority on seizing the initiative in conflict regardless of the cost. He also knew how to get the most out of the men working under him, and he'd never missed a deadline or a target that he was ordered to attain.
"Screw this. They can give us another candidate. I won't work with that man. He'll have no place on my staff," Sheridan said.
Ed took a deep breath. There were worse candidates, but not much.
"Just listen to me for a second," he said.
Sheridan looked squarely at the camera, his face red with anger.
"Make it short.
You can deny their candidate, but if you do, the negotiations will get bogged down for months. We're already on borrowed time, and we're not sure when our time is going to run out. We don't need a perfect army to go to war with, and we only have this one chance to get in front of this thing without massive casualties, Ed said.
Ed felt as if there were a train thundering in his ears while he watched Sheridan think about what he'd said. Suddenly, the holoscreen went dark. Sheridan had cut the connection, and Ed swore. There were contingency plans should the ECF fail at this juncture, but it would put their manufacturing model out 5 years without help from the Chinese and the Russians. If they had global support, they could have ships completed within another year. They didn't have time to crawl or stumble. They had to learn to run, and run as fast as they could. Iris closed down the mobile communication center and turned toward him.
"What do you think he'll do?" she asked.
Ed shrugged. "I'm not sure. I know what I want him to do, but Sheridan is in a tough position. The repercussions of his decisions will affect generations to come."
"You know, I have 5 older brothers," Iris said.
Ed shook his head.
"I didn't know that."
"Yep, and they were all strong-willed and fought with each other constantly. It wasn't until our mother put them to work that they started to get along."
"What did she have them do?"
"She bought an old car that needed a lot of work and told them that if they could fix it up, they could drive the car. So, grumbling and cursing and a few bruises later, they eventually fixed that car up. Then they fixed up another car and word got spread around. Eventually, they opened a repair shop that they all still operate to this day," Iris said.
"So you think if we just force them to work together, they'll work their differences out?" "I'm not sure that's going to work in this case," Ed said.
"It would be nice if it did. If you want my honest opinion, I don't think the UN Security Council is scared enough. We had a close call with that asteroid, but the fight has hardly come to our backyard," Iris said.
"Sheridan gets it. He understands what's at stake."
"You're right. He does, to an extent. Heng Shang can deliver results. We may not like the method, but at least we'll be alive to have the preference. Sheridan should make use of Shang, but also try to keep him honest," Iris said.
"I had no idea you were so pragmatic."
"That's crap, and you know it. One more thing that was made clear from that meeting, the UN Security Council doesn't get what's at stake. They still think there's a way for them to survive what's coming without banding together," Iris said.
Ed headed for the door to the house.
"Well, we'll just have to change their minds, won't we?"
Chapter 4 Michael Hunsicker had more or less taken up permanent residence on Armstrong Lunar Base. He'd been back to Colorado to visit his grandkids, but only for a short period, and his children understood why he needed to leave them again. Since getting back to Earth, he felt he had a new lease on life. He visited Catherine's grave and told her about all he'd been through. He would always miss her, but now felt more at peace with her passing than he ever had. And it wasn't long before he was recruited to join the Earth Coalition Force on loan from NASA, as it were. He was the foremost expert and liaison to the Boxons. During his short stint back home, he'd noticed how people still watched the new moon with a sense of trepidation. Michael approved the way General Sheridan hadn't sugarcoated the news that the Zaijins had sent the behemoth-sized asteroid to destroy the Earth. The Boxons believed the Zaijins used the asteroid as a ploy to divide the people of Earth. Misinformation was a strategy the Zaijins often employed to achieve their goals. The ploy had nearly worked and had been almost catastrophic for Earth. After weeks of analysis, it had been generally accepted that after the Boxon dreadnoughts were destroyed, it was the shroud barrier that had prevented the Zaijin fleet from reaching Earth. The Boxons confirmed that the engine farm that had propelled the new moon toward the Earth was of Zaijin design, and the barrier prevented any abort signal the Zaijins would have sent to prevent Earth's destruction. It had been a carefully orchestrated gambit, with the Earth caught in the crosshairs. Those engines had been disabled and the materials repurposed for the mining stations that had been built all over the new moon. Over the months, the lunar base had become more of a colony, with additions to the existing base being added to accommodate the additional ECF personnel working up there. The Boxins had also built their own habitat on the lunar surface, even though there had been many offers for the Boxins to come to Earth. They did go to the planet's surface, but only for short periods of time. Michael had asked Chazen about this behavior, and the Boxin had simply said it was for the best at this point. The Boxins did, however, make themselves available to advise the new technological centers springing up all over Earth. It would be a joint effort to build the ECF's first fleet to protect the planet. It didn't make sense to bring all the materials mined from the new moon down to Earth's surface in any significant capacity. Near the mining outposts, the Boxan tech platforms left by Praxpedax were being put to good use. The platforms had enabled them to get to a point where producing the materials needed for ships was taking months instead of years. The ECF Engineering Division had even been able to build their own tech platforms based on what they'd been taught by the Boxins. A reminder message appeared on Michael's internal heads-up display, and underneath came a text message from Alyssa. "Breakfast?" "You bet. I'll be right there," Michael sent back. He finished dressing and left his room. Alyssa Archer was the commander in charge of running Lunar Base. Since he'd first arrived here from Pluto, he and Alyssa had become fast friends. They were both in their 50s. He was a widower, and she was divorced. They enjoyed each other's company, and both of them had decided not to make it any more complicated than that. She had a strong, no-nonsense attitude that he liked. At this stage in his life, he didn't want to try to guess what she was thinking, and she had never been one to hold her opinion back. Michael's stomach growled. Bacon and eggs, followed by a cup of coffee, were calling his name. Perhaps he'd even indulge in some toast. With his mouth watering, he closed in on the officer's mess hall. But before he could reach it, Alyssa walked out and waved over to him.
"Change of plans. We've got to meet with the Marais Corporation's representative now instead of later," Alyssa said.
Michael glanced longingly at the mess hall, smelling the rich aroma of breakfast food. Alyssa tossed a protein bar toward him, and he caught it. He looked at the prepackaged block that was supposed to tie him over.
"Thanks," Michael said.
"Don't be such a baby,"
Alyssa said, and quickened her pace. Michael tore open the package and bit into the protein bar that was ostensibly some mix of coconut, chocolate, and peanut butter. But most of all, it lacked any kind of flavor. Hopefully, there'd be some coffee in the conference room on the ECF wing of the base.
"Why'd they move the meeting up?" Michael asked.
"All redline projects get priority, and right now we've got a bunch of Marais mechs here that we can't use," Alyssa said.
They came to the security checkpoint and used their neural implants to authenticate, after which the doors opened and they entered the new ECF wing of the base. The hallways were larger and the ceiling much higher in order to accommodate the Boxins who also worked there. The gray, lunar rock walls had been smoothed down but still had a bit of roughness to them. They entered the command center, and if the ECF wing had been a ship, then the command center would have been the bridge. It was a large, semicircular room with different work areas for the various teams assigned there. Michael spotted Colonel Kyle Matthews speaking with Chazen and one Boxin soldier whose name he couldn't recall.
"We need to get the mechs up and running ASAP," they heard Colonel Matthews saying.
Michael and Alyssa walked over, and Kyle greeted them.
"Great, you're here," Kyle said. "Maybe now you'll tell the Marais Corp representative to find a way to get things working before I order them scrapped and used for strike fighters."
"What's the problem?"
Michael said, and glanced down through the window at a cavernous work area. Off to the side were two lines of hulking robotic mechs that were made by the Marais Corporation based out of South Korea. The manned mechs could be adapted to a variety of tasks, from combat to working with heavy materials.
"In layman terms, we're having power issues, and the onboard computers seem a bit flaky," Kyle said.
A man named Lewis was about to speak, but Kyle cut him off.
"I know it's more technical than that, but ultimately that's what the problem is," Kyle said.
They headed over to the conference room located away from the command center, and the automatic door shut behind them. Holo screens powered on, and a comms channel was opened planetside. Three men appeared on screen. All had short dark hair and wore dark suits.
"Hello, Bakjansa. Are you able to see us?"
Alyssa asked.
"Loud and clear, Mrs. Archer," Bakjansa said.
"It's Miss. I haven't been a Mrs. in a long time," Alyssa said.
"Apologies,"
Bakjansa said, and then introduced his two companions. Mehyo was the head robotics engineer, and Kam Min-su was the department head for the mech's operating system. After the introductions, Bak Jun-sa focused his gaze on Michael.
"It's our honor to be speaking to you, Mr. Hansuke," Bak Jun-sa said.
Michael bowed his head slightly, and the Koreans returned the bow in kind.
"I've had our teams here review the reported problems, and we do have some options to present," Bak Jun-sa said.
Lewis cleared his throat, and Alyssa nodded for him to speak.
"If you have a software patch for the mech operating system, you can transmit that here and we'll review and test it before it gets deployed to the other mechs."
"This will not be possible," Kam Min-su said.
"Why the hell not?" Lewis asked.
"The code is proprietary and only Mirai employees are authorized to update the kernel of the mech's operating system code," Kam Min-su said.
"You've got to be kidding me," Lewis said, and glanced over at Kyle.
The colonel looked as if he were about to spit fire.
"You guys realize that we're working from the moon? This isn't some operation where we can just come and get you to fix your damn broken mechs."
Michael suspected the colonel had been about to call the mechs something else entirely. Bak Jun-sa regarded them calmly.
"We do realize this complicates things, but this is the only way we can vouch for the proper operation of our mechs."
Colonel Matthews turned away, shaking his head.
"Mute the call," he said.
The comms tech running the meeting told the Marais representatives that they needed a minute.
"Call muted, sir,"
the comms tech said.
"This is bullshit," Kyle said.
"It is," Alyssa said, "and they won't be the first to try this tactic with us."
"Well, we can't give in to this crap. Even if I wanted their employees here, Sheridan's staff would never authorize it. The ECF may be a new organization, but it's still run like a military branch," Kyle said.
"What choice do we have?" Michael asked.
He didn't have a head for this sort of politics. He knew how to solve problems directly in front of him, but this was an entirely new arena for him.
"I'm sure that with a little bit of time I could update the code myself," Lewis said.
Michael glanced at the engineer. He had brown curly hair and looked to be in his 30s. Lewis's statement about updating the code himself reminded him of Zack Quick. It wasn't the first time he'd thought about the hacker-turned-astronaut. If Zack had been here, Michael was sure he would have already updated the code and gotten the mechs working before the rest of them even knew there was a problem to begin with.
"How much time would that take? And then we'd run the risk of introducing other problems with our fix," Michael said.
"What about the Boxons? Could we ask for their help?"
Lewis asked. Both Kyle and Alyssa shook their heads.
"We can't go run to the Boxons to sort out our issues for us. We should be able to handle this ourselves," Kyle said.
"I say we hand this up the chain. We give Sheridan the options, along with our recommendation, and let them decide," Alyssa said.
Michael nodded.
"The ECF is supposed to be bringing in people from all the nations supporting the effort."
"Yeah, but in the meantime, this sets us behind," Kyle said.
Alyssa was commander of the base, but this was ECF-related, and currently Colonel Kyle Matthews was the ranking officer, so the decision was up to him. Kyle glanced over at the comms tech.
"Open the channel back up."
The Koreans turned back toward the holoscreen.
"We await your decision," Bak Jun-sa said.
"I'll authorize 4 of your techs to come here to fix our mechs. The one condition I must insist on is that Kam Min-su and Mehyo be the 2 leads that come as well," Kyle said.
Kam Min-su's skin paled, and he glanced at the others nervously.
"Acceptable," Bak Jun-sa said.
Kam Min-su swallowed hard.
"I'll need some time to gather my team and the equipment we'll need."
"You have 1 hour," Kyle said. "I'll have a shuttle brought right to Mirai headquarters to pick you and the other 2 members of your team up."
Kam Min-su was about to reply when Kyle cut the comms channel.
"Do you think Sheridan will go along with this?" Alyssa asked. "He cares that we get things done. I'll send him an update and he can countermand the order if he wants, but he won't. I have operational authority here and he needs those damn mechs working," Kyle said, and he looked at Lewis. "When the Koreans get here, I want you and Alan to be with them at all times. They may have bartered their way onto this base, but this is going to be a knowledge-sharing job for them. If they don't like it, then I'm sure I know a few people who can properly convince them for me."
Michael felt his lips curve upward. He was glad Kyle was in charge of this. He'd get results and knew how to apply the right amount of pressure to get the job done.
Why bring Kam Min-su and Mae-hyo here? Michael asked.
Because they're department heads who know the ins and outs of those mechs. If Murray Corp wanted to get cute and barter their way onto this base, I'm sure as hell going to get the most out of this deal, Kyle answered.
Michael watched the colonel for a moment. He'd seemed angry before, and while he was still annoyed by the Koreans, it hadn't distracted him from what was important.
Kyle Matthews was one of the reasons Earth was still here, and the rest of them still had a place to call home.
Come on, I need you to kindly ask the Boxens to pick up a few people for me, Kyle said, grinning.
Michael snorted and knew this wouldn't be the last time a country or corporation would try to use their position of supporting the ECF as a way to muscle their way inside. Chapter 5 Kalen stood on the Athena's bridge with Emma. The crew rotated coming back to the Athena, and it felt much like a homecoming. They'd been given living quarters on the planet that were quite comfortable, but the Athena was the only place they could really call their own. Emma sighed.
It feels good to be back, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Kalen agreed.
I have to admit that when we first got to Oleron, I couldn't wait to get off the ship and feel solid ground beneath my feet. Now I just want to get back home,
Emma said, and there was a catch in her voice.
We'll get home,
Kalen said, giving Emma a hug.
And Tom will be waiting for you. You'll have your wedding.
Emma laughed.
I feel so stupid,
she said, and pulled away, wiping her eyes.
I know we'll get home. I have to believe it, but I just miss him so much. I keep replaying his last video message to me. He was holding our dog at our favorite park, trying to get him to wave at the camera.
Kalen's eyes became misty as well.
How are you and Zack doing?
Emma asked.
Oh, we're fine,
Kalen said a little too quickly. And knew Emma wasn't fooled.
We try to be discreet, but lately there just hasn't been a lot of time, and sometimes he can be... Zack,
Emma supplied.
Yes, Kalen
laughed.
What would you do if Tom were here?
Emma frowned.
You mean after I jumped his bones all night because I haven't gotten laid in over a year?
Kalen felt her cheeks redden. Emma was usually so well-spoken with her British accent that to hear her like this was sometimes disarming.
I don't know if he and I being in a confined space like a ship would be best for our relationship. Don't get me wrong, I love him, madly, but sometimes... men,
Emma said. Kalen didn't mind being near Zack, but she also understood what Emma meant. Her sister Iris loved her husband, but needed her own space to help balance it out.
Have you thought what you and Zack will do after we get back home?
Emma asked.
Take a vacation on a beach somewhere far away and not be bothered by anyone else for a while. That's what I'd want. But given all this, I doubt we'll be any less busy than we are right now,
Kalen said. Emma nodded.
Indeed. All this,
she said as she went over to the conference table and turned on the holo display.
I wanted to talk to you about the Boxens.
Kalen walked over.
What about them? I've been doing my own analysis of Oleron and the Boxen population,
Emma said.
Okay. What have you found out?
Kalen asked.
It's strange. The Boxens don't reproduce fast, but on their home planet, the population numbered in the billions, according to their records. Here on Oleron, there are only a few hundred million of them. They've been here for 50 years, give or take, and their population hasn't changed that much,
Emma said.
Well, they have been fighting a war,
Kalen said.
I've accounted for that, but even with that, the population isn't growing and cannot be sustained on this planet,
Emma said. Kalen's forehead wrinkled. Emma was a biologist, and this was her field.
Are you sure? Yes. I've run my analysis half a dozen times, and it all indicates that Oleron cannot sustain the Boxens for more than 100 years at the most. That's assuming they can even maintain their population. One of the reasons I wanted to come up here was to have Athena look at my data models to see if they're correct,
Emma said. Kalen watched as Emma transferred a file from her PDA and uploaded it to Athena's data storage.
I'd be happy to look at your work, Dr. Roberson,
the AI said.
Analyzing. Complete.